everybody. So yesterday I was compared to Megyn Kelly. And my interlocutor was, I guess, in that role, Donald Trump. If you missed that presentation, it was huge. This is going to be the best panel we've ever had. We just want to note that there are female contributors to this book, several. It's not an oversight, it's just explicit repression. No one knows. So this is not an attempt at male domination or anything. So this is our quick panel about this lovely book, which we can get right at the book table. What's the price on this? $14, but you can haggle, I'm sure. Paul Zoll, everybody. Before we start to talk a little bit about film and how grace in practice meets us in film, I wanted to actually start with a film clip from a movie that is one of my favorite movies, and in which New York is almost like a character in the film, Crimes and Misdemeanors. So if we could roll it.
We're all very proud of Judah Rosenthal's philanthropic efforts, his endless hours of fundraising for the hospital, the new medical center, and now the ophthalmology wing, which until this year had just been a dream. But it's Judah Rosenthal, our friend, that we most appreciate, the husband, the father, the golf companion. Naturally, if you have a medical problem, you can call Judah day or night, weekends or holidays. But you can also call Judah to find out which is the best restaurant in Paris, or Athens, or which hotel to stay at in Moscow, or the best recording of a particular Mozart symphony.
My father is so nervous about having to get up and speak.
I know. I knew he was nervous when you didn't eat any of those cocktail weenies at hors d'oeuvres.
You were so courageous all week, then suddenly tonight, stage fright.
Really, Judah, you were fine till you got home from work today.
Any mail?
The mail's exactly where I left it this morning. I haven't had a free second all day.
If you're going to take a shower, you better do it because I have to use it too. I dread making that speech tonight.
Dear Miriam Rosenthal, I am at the lowest point of my life as I write you this letter. I wish to cause no suffering, but because I'm going through pure hell, I ask if you can meet me one time. Your husband and I are more than intimate friends and have been deeply in love for over 2 years now. This must be faced as there are so many ramifications and complications. Many promises were made, etc. I need an open exchange with you to clear things. For all three of us to go on, the situation has got to be confronted in some fashion. Please contact me at this number. I want what's best for everyone. Dolores Paley.
That the new ophthalmology wing has become a reality is not just a tribute to me, but to a spirit of community, generosity, of mutual caring, and answered prayers. Now, it's funny I use the term answered prayers. You see, I'm a man of science. I've always been a skeptic, but I was raised quite religiously. And while I challenged it, even as a child, some of that feeling must have stuck with me. I remember my father telling me, the eyes of God are on us always. The eyes of God.
What a phrase to a young boy. I mean, what were God's eyes like? Unimaginably penetrating, intense eyes, I assumed. And I wonder if it was just a coincidence that I made my specialty ophthalmology.
It's in it there. Yeah, there you go. So one of the things I remember hearing an avant-garde filmmaker, Nathan Dorsky, talk about the ways cameras are used in film. And I mean, if you go to a Blockbuster, right, you want to have fun, sit in the nice seats and eat overpriced popcorn and just like have an escapist entertainment thing, you want to like bleed into the film. So the camera, I mean, if you're making that kind of film, you don't want people to be aware of the camera. Like, you want it to be like a GoPro reality, like you're there, you're Superman flying, and you know, it's a first person kind of experience. Avant-garde film, you're often painfully aware of the camera. Like, you can't get away from the filmmaker's lens. But I think really, really great film is where it slips in between those kinds of moments where, like, in Crimes and Misdemeanors, eyes are a metaphor for during the whole thing. So when people wear glasses or take them off, it's very symbolic. There's a scene where he's going to cover up an awful misdeed or a crime, and you see this round headlight. It's perfectly round, and it just goes out. So there are these moments where there's these artistic shots, and then there are kind of more mundane, gritty shots. So I'm wondering for you on the panel, where do you think in film, as connoisseurs, lovers of film, what films do you think best kind of merge form and content? Like, what are those... What are those experiences that aesthetically really pull it off for you?
The films of Michael Bay, of course. I mean, it's sort of an interesting question because that's not really the way that I watch a film the first time. That's sort of the way I watch a film the 10th or 11th time, which I'm not unhappy to do, by the way. But it's interesting to think about sort of when you come to a movie or a film. It's almost a way that, like, are you watching a movie, you having fun, or are you watching a film where you're analyzing things like that? And the first 7 or 8 times, I'm just having fun. And it's only when you sort of start to bring yourself, the things about yourself that maybe you don't even know, to a movie, that you start to have it sort of, in a sense, speak back to you. And it's sort of, in a way, it's, and I'm sort of rambling now, but in a way, it's sort of like reading the Bible, in that there comes a point where it means perhaps even more than the writer even knew. Where somebody like Michael Bay, for instance, who is a stylist first and foremost, and is basically unconcerned about content at all. It's all about beautiful image after beautiful image. And all of a sudden, even watching some of his films, you can say, oh my gosh, like there's a beauty there that he probably was shooting for something else, but all of a sudden it's speaking to me in a way that's transcending me and him and the story about bad boys, what you're going to do, that form and content are greater even than the crafter was shooting for, and then there's something transcendent there that I've heard filmmakers say, like, I didn't even know about that headlight. Like, that was an accident. Or I thought the frame had actually removed that, and there it was. And I know, it's sort of like Derek Webb was saying last night. And he says, I wrote a song, but I forget why I wrote it. I forget who I was at that time. And yet these films from the 70s and 80s speak in new ways to us every day. I'm going to stop talking now.
I think that the reason we were put in the world is to escape from it and to be saved from it and to be healed of the insufferable problematic givens that make life living hell at certain points for most people. And so I am constantly looking for ways to be healed. I'm just looking like a person looking for water in a desert. I'm looking for a means to be healed. What movies do, and this is the unconscious power of them, and it's why they're the number one art form popularly and have always been since they were founded, is that they allow a person who's sitting on undigested negative material to abreact or find catharsis through a resonance with the movie experience that touches my experience. So I am touched. My own pain is somehow drawn out by the pain, and sometimes my love or my joy is drawn out, and I find myself understood by the abreactive emotions that are kindled in me by the movie. And that, by the way, guys are much more analytical about movies than girls in the most. Girls just like the movie. Guys are always talking about the frames and the angles and the compositions. And Mary just gets, she's basically had it with ever watching a movie with me. But what I want to say, it's the emotional, abreactive, and cathartic power of the situation which elicits unconscious, powerful feelings in you that creates the magic of the movie moment. And I would bet that almost everyone's favorite movie has something to do with having touched something very powerful that existed already that didn't have a voice.
Are there certain things aesthetically you think that, like, this is kind of what I'm getting at, like, are there certain, if you get too far to the extreme, either too artsy or too sort of CGI eye cocaine, where the ab reaction is hard to happen, but I think there's really good art, good films kind of sneak up on you. I think it's a delicate balance that really great films are kind of, it's a real delicate art form.
Is this on? Yeah, this is on. One thing that I think just with the idea of sort of film analysis that I might want to add is that it's really secondary, like actually trying to dissect a movie or something, you know. There's plenty of songs that can make me cry on any given day, and I don't know music theory. The film gets across regardless of sort of how much you want to dissect it or how much you don't. And I think one thing that's great for me, a lot of times when I'm in sort of analysis mode, it has a way of detaching me from the film. So, like, I was probably far more moved by This Is 40 from Judd Apatow than I was from the last Orson Welles movie I watched, because there's not the pressure there, and it really sneaks up on you. And you start out in the guise of sort of thinking this is just sort of a lighthearted, funny movie, and then it just sort of socks you in the gut halfway through, and you realize that what you've been watching is a sort of film of utmost seriousness, but because it seems playful, you let your guard down. So that's just sort of a particular kind of film, I think, that probably is pretty well represented in the book. And I think having permission to actually engage the material of the film as opposed to feeling like you're having to break it down is really, for me, has been the secret to a lot of things.
John, please.
I'm always looking for a movie that will get through to me in spite of all the walls that I have up, conscious and unconscious, and I went through a phase where I felt a little bit blocked, spiritually, emotionally, I don't know what, but basically, I wanted to watch a movie that would make me cry, and so I got like a Facebook post going, tell me the movies that'll make me cry, and I started going through them, you know, and so, yeah, I was like, anybody have any ideas, and so I watched The Joy Luck Club. And I watched The English Patient, and I watched Old Yeller, and I was so blocked, I started to feel even worse because they didn't do the trick. My analytical mind kept kicking in. I couldn't get past certain script stuff or acting, and finally I went back to the old doozy, It's a Wonderful Life, And it opened up the gates again. It was amazing.
The end of Armageddon will also get you.
Yeah. There's nothing like the joy of going to see a movie that completely gets through and you don't see it coming. And for me, one that really did that in a powerful way was, of all things, the movie Apocalypto by Mel Gibson. I wasn't familiar with any of the actors. I don't think I know a lot about Mayan films, and so it just, there weren't a lot of presuppositions.
Easy, Mayan films.
I know, Dad would have had a hard time. But I remember going to see that movie at a time when life was going on in my life, and at the end of it, I felt really that I had just prayed about every single thing in my life that was on my mind and in my heart. And many of those things I was not thinking about when I walked into the movie. And the movie somehow drew them out of me. And I'll watch that movie in order to figure out what it is in my life that I really have not been able to sort of talk to God about. And that's a weird one, but for me, I watch Apocalypto when I want to unearth and excavate my heart spiritually, because it just draws everything that's real about life and important to the surface, and just is gut-wrenching, and somehow also provides something nourishing into that thirst and hunger. It's
interesting, because we're using different verbs here. Like some people are saying, when I watched, and some people are saying, when I've gone to, and like, I mean, Paul, you've talked a lot about just going to the movies as a kid and these being these sanctuaries kind of. I wonder, too, this video killed the radio star. I hope that's not true because I like radio. But I wonder, has home cinema, like the fact that you can have this really dynamic HD screen, combined with the serial drama, like if you would have told me Halle Berry would go from the big screen to doing a sci-fi serial on network television, and now binge watching, you can basically get a 14-hour movie dropped on you like House of Cards. I mean, I wonder, how is that changing the cinematic experience? Because it's different when you, Paul, when you're growing up, you kind of had to go with, and it's a communal experience. I mean, in a theater where a lot of people just, that's an irregularity.
Well, I hear that loud and clear, and my life was completely, totally changed by Edgar Allan Poe movies in 1961, so I'm with you. But I just thought that was ironically funny, but I want to stay with John's point. Who's Edgar Allan Poe? Who's Halle Berry? But I want to actually, I want to stay with the point, though. Why do people find movies so powerful? And I think the Apocalypto point, we're all trying to be healed. I mean, this is what everybody's deep down wanting to do, is be healed. And that's what movies are, one important vehicle. But I'm, David?
David? I like movies about fractured father-son dynamics. Just kidding.
I can honestly say that Michael Mann's film version of the show Miami Vice that he made in years later, the Miami Vice movie, that movie honestly convinced me that marrying my wife was not going to ruin her life. I was actually going into it feeling like, does she really want to marry a priest? Does she really want to move to South Carolina? Is this going to be fair to her? Is this going to be such an upheaval of everything that she's familiar with? And at the end of that movie, I knew it was okay.
At least you're not an undercover drug cop.
Exactly. Anyway, yeah. There's a scene in the movie where she realizes that the man she's in love with is not what she thought he was. And he actually drags her to safety as she's kicking and screaming against safety and wanting to still protect the drug lord who she works for. And in that moment, I had the thought, wow, she doesn't, if you really do think that this actually, if you can see how this could be good for her, go with that. And don't worry so much about her initial perception of the experience of coming to the south of the Mason-Dixon. And sure enough, she loves where we live. It's been a huge change, and it's been so rewarding to watch it all unfold. And I was able to do it sort of in confidence because of Miami Vice.
I'm surprised there's not a folks, I'm not folks gonna say song with that else. Title. Like,
I'm about to completely ruin the ending of Lassie Come Home, if that's okay.
Okay.
I was 5 or 6, and my mom put me in front of Lassie Come Home. I think it was the second or third version of it with Timmy that was made around the TV series. And, you know, Lassie's gone and works her way across continents back to Timmy throughout the movie. And Timmy has given up at the end of the movie, and there's the scene where he's kind of below in the valley of a mountainside, and he's burying Lassie's toys, and tears are streaming down his face, and he's throwing the dirt on the toys. And then you hear a distant, faint bark from beyond the mountainside, and Lassie comes limping over the mountain. And I'm sitting there, and I'm 5, 6 years old. And there was something about life coming from death that I resonated with. I couldn't have articulated that, obviously, then. But I think that put me on the path that this can make, even though I am a mess, I still kind of like this, you know. And so now it's kind of even devolved for me into watching massive dysfunction. It just was scenes of familial dysfunction and letting it destroy me that I'm comfortable with. I don't know if that's good or bad, but but it all started, I think, by that very visceral response I had to something very simple early on. So,
one of the things that actually drew me to Mockingbird was originally back in like 2010 was the writing that many of you and others who've been part of Mockingbird have done on movies. And I found it to be really accessible for everyone's reasons here. But it also helped sort of take some of the teeth of the law out of watching movies for me, because there's, you know, I'm insufferable because I had one film class in undergrad, right? And so I know everything, and I can go to the movies and just enjoy it, right? And I have the analytic part of it. But you know, I didn't have it all the time. And to be able to come and talk about these movies, and it's one of the things I appreciate about the book, is there's you know, you talk about more obscure directors, more avant-garde stuff, and you know, there's some distance that can really come in through there. But one of the first articles I read about on Mockingbird was about Netflix when it was delivering DVDs, and this is before streaming Netflix that we all know and love now. Do you still get the DVDs? Okay. Well, according to statistics, the number one most long rented DVD in like 2010 or whatever was Hotel Rwanda. Because everybody was told they had to see it, but it's about the Rwanda genocide. Nobody wants to like veg out after a hard day of work and watch a movie about the Rwanda genocide. I mean, it's important to do, but like, you know, I felt the same way about Schindler's List. I had it like next to my TV for 3 years or ish before I actually dove in. And to hear that, yeah, everyone's that same way was actually very freeing to me. And it helped me to sort of say, well, you know what? I can write a Mockingbird post about Warm Bodies, this ridiculous zombie romantic comedy from like 2013 or something. I don't know. And it was like zombies and Romeo and Juliet. And you can look it up. And but it was so, it's profoundly theological about death and being raised to life by a one-way love. I mean, it's great stuff. So I just wanted to say, like, at least in the book, I think it's got that same vibe. That it takes the teeth out of, you know, I'm plugging the book now, but it takes the teeth out of this sort of, oh, well, I'm not a movie person. But even if you like, you know, we've been joking about Michael Bay or the Steven Spielberg stuff or the, you know, the romantic comedy sort of, treadmill, you know, all the romantic comedies, like, that's fine. Like, that, there's still a place for that in our lives, and we shouldn't necessarily have to feel, you know, less of a movie viewer to experience that.
Al Mohler was recently on one of my favorite podcasts, Unorthodox. It's three Jewish writers, and they're great. And they always have a Gentile of the Week. And Al Mohler, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, was their Gentile of the Week. And they always say, we have three expert Jews here. Ask us anything you want. I said, well, what's a good film for evangelicals to understand the Jewish the Jewish experience? And Leo Leibowitz, one of the guys, says, well, I was on a panel deciding. The least Jewish film. in Schindler's List, because it's really about a Christian Messiah saving a bunch of Jews. We found the best for the Jewish American experience is E.T., because it's about somebody that comes to America, they look kind of funny, they don't really fit in, they're physically awkward, but they have a strange proclivity for the medical arts, and everybody likes them in the end. That's Do you want to say something about Redbeard?
My favorite. You might want to read the last essay in the book. It's on Redbeard. It's my favorite movie. I love it deeply, and I tried to share why and how it speaks to me theologically. I've learned a lot from that movie. That said, I know only Nick Lannon has actually seen it in its entirety of almost anybody I know. And so, yeah, okay, even he skipped some parts. Yeah, anyway. It's my favorite movie. You can hear the podcast on it if you want.
It's stellar.
I recommend that everyone here, before you leave New York today, go to the southwest axis of Union Square, where there's a little table run by a guy named Scott with a beret, and he has a sale on of Redbeard right now. You can buy Redbeard for $1, the complete Criterion collection, and it will change your life forever. Southwest axis, ask for Scott. Seriously, he's having a sale on Redbeard today. Scott.
But if you watch it and it doesn't change your life at all, you can read my essay, which will at least make sense, I hope, of why it is that I love it. And that will hopefully give you eyes to at least maybe get something out of the experience of watching a 3.5-hour Japanese movie in black and white.
I mean, that's the case with all of these movies. You can't actually choose what's going to speak to you. You know, you have your own personal defenses up that, and so it may be embarrassing that what actually speaks to you is Harry Potter, or some movie like Miami Vice, but. That's like what the collection of these essays really come down to is, here's where I was, and maybe I didn't even know it, but this movie gave me the words to express what I need to say to God and what God needs to say to me.
What movie's done that for you,
Thanks,
Mr. Richardson?
Dave. Well, during my talk, I really wanted to be able to fit Silver Linings Playbook in here, just because the Bradley Cooper character, I won't ruin anything if you haven't seen it, but he's in such a low place, but he's in such denial about where he is, and there's a he's given a sort of wounded healer. You know, this woman comes into his life that is completely out of the blue. But he can't accept the fact that he is, that he's the same as her. He can't accept her wounds because he's not wounded. And so the movie is basically him coming to terms with himself. And in coming to terms with himself, he finds that that love is there too. And it's so beautiful. The end, it was definitely one of those moments where I completely lost it.
One of my wife Lindy's favorite scenes in that movie is when he reads Farewell to Arms, and it seems like it's going to be happy, and the end is so dark, and he throws the book out the window. She's like, that's exactly what I felt when I read the book. David, you've written about Wes Anderson. One of my favorite scenes from Royal Tenenbaums is at the end. I mean, I think that's one of the most redemptive sort of dark comedies I've ever seen, but the end where Gene Hackman's kind of a humble Gene Hackman turns to Danny Glover's character and says, you know, I'm sorry, I've been a real asshole. And he says, no, Royal, you're not an asshole. You're more of a son of a bitch. Could you say a little bit about, like, Wes Anderson?
Wes Anderson?
Yep.
I love Wes Anderson. I think those movies are often actually critiqued as being distant because they're so precise and so carefully designed. And I think that there's probably a little bit of that, but for me, it's always a sucker punch, because what he does is he always includes some totally catastrophic scene in the midst of all this preciousness and humor, and then all of a sudden someone tries to commit suicide, or there's a storm that wipes everyone out, or a tail gets chopped off. That was last one was a joke. The or like a child dies, and people are always brought back to reality. The characters are, and you are in the film too, because you've been consumed with the charming details, and then all of a sudden God appears in the form of a catastrophe, and under his opposite, and you are thrust back into feeling, and you realize the film was doing something that you didn't think it was doing. And no one wants to talk about God and Wes Anderson, least of all him, but it's writ very, very large to me, and maybe that's what I'm bringing to it. But those movies, you know, you put some Kinks in there, or The Who singing "I Am Forgiven," and I'm toast. You know, like those are my personal defenses are down at that point. And no matter what happens, even if it's a silly something that a Vietnam high school play, it's going to get me on a gut level because I wasn't expecting it.
There's a verse in the Bible that says, unless you become like a child, you have to become a child to enter the kingdom of heaven, basically. And you can spend 30 hours researching commentaries on that, doing a little small group and talking about it, or you can just watch Moonrise Kingdom and get the exact same message, maybe even at a deeper level. And I think that part of that is sort of our mode of interacting with films. It's fundamentally a very passive thing. When you're reading a book, you can sort of pause and take stuff apart and dissect it, put the book down, you know, go make a cup of coffee, pick it back up. A film is, it's just sort of a continuous thing, and I feel like that's where some of the power comes from, is the passivity of the viewer and the sort of situation that the viewer's placed in. And sometimes, I think, especially with really good movies, it almost feels like this suffering. You're just bound up in this sort of process that's going on, and just sort of thinking about film as a medium, along with sort of other mediums, I think that's one of the things that makes film really powerful for me, but also kind of makes it hard to watch sometimes. Hard to sit down and start a movie and know that I'm just sort of giving myself over to this film, this director, whatever, for the next 2.5 hours, but I think it really, they can speak with a power because of that passivity that it's hard to find in other places sometimes.
Wow. Well, maybe the people watching this on the internet will feel that same way.
Exactly.
But Scott, I want to say that the guy who actually edited the book is not up here. He should be. His name is C.J. Green, and he's extremely gifted. C.J., are you here? Yes.
CJ.
We have him
stand
to thank.
Stand up, CJ.
And David Peterson for actually putting this thing together. And so proud of it.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that if I were a preacher, I would ask everyone in the room to, you see, there's an enormous principle in life that you could call this: when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Another way of putting it is, when you're really in a crisis and you really cry out for help, help always comes. Despite what the world says, which has an ideological nihilism, there is not really an empirical nihilism. If you are actually at the end of your rope and you acknowledge it, help always comes. It often comes in the form of a movie. So ask yourself, what movie has been brought to you at a time of real quandary and sadness and misery? And how has that movie illuminated powerfully your situation and thereby offered you grace and acceptance? And I'll bet you everybody here can name one particular film that played that role.
Paul, can I just ask, one of the things that I think, as we wrap up, this has been on my mind, one of the things I think you do well in your podcast, like, you have a low anthropology, a realistic anthropology, you know, you're very honest about the human condition, and yet you have a childlike way of viewing the world, whether it's film or television or fantasy. I mean, I think it's one of the part of the spirit of Mockingbird. I'm just wondering, how did that develop? Because we see people go one or the other way. They can be very realistic about human beings, but cynical about the world, or people that are lovers of the world, but naive about people.
Well, it sounds like such a totally lame cliche, but there's this thing called the inner child. And one of the great things about Mockingbird is it acknowledges the decisive role of the inner child. And as a little tiny 8-year-old child, I would go on the bus to the movies, and I would just sit there with my eyes open, and just my world was just unbelievably made an impression on. And Mockingbird's greatest vocation is to bring the inner child of men and women into contact with the divine parent by means of the instrument of suffering. That is the essence of what religion is all about. And Mockingbird, not trying to utilize movies as an evangelistic tool, but as a way of explicating why our emotions are so powerfully excavated by this material, it is an unbeatable combination. So that's what it is, to be in touch with the inner child. And everybody here has one. Some of you are a little too adult. I'm just saying that. Now, not you. Mostly people in the social progressive side of the church have no inner child. But if you're here, you're probably someone who's discontented with whatever side of the church you've been on. And Mockingbird is all about ministering to your inner child.
Thank you, everybody.